Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH. Know Your Risk Radio is hosted by Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often volatile markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
And we are back. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for yet another of the most scintillating hours in finance radio. And we got a good one. Look, I'm talking my own book to some extent. We had a really nice week. Market, not so much. Market pretty much sideways on the week, if not slightly down. Our portfolios were up sharply. But more importantly to me, it really appears like we're on a breakout. I was telling our folks with us on KTTH in the opener, we set a new high water mark on the value portfolio this year, and several different things that we're watching have broken out now of this sideways grind and appear to be breaking out on the high side. Now we need to see it confirmed, right? I'd like to see follow through tomorrow, because it's remarkably uncommittal. The NASDAQ got right back up to that previous all-time high and pulled right back down yet again. ARK, our old friend ARK, under deep pressure. And we're going to talk a little bit more about ARK. We've got a wide variety of things to discuss in our interview today. But we're going to be joined again by Edwin Dorsey, very young and very sharp analyst, that's really digging into things on the short side. So doing a lot of short research, looking for frauds, looking for scam-type companies. If you've listened to the show, you're familiar with his work. He's been on here before. And I just think he does extraordinarily thorough research that's shocking for his age and his experience level. I think he's got a very promising future. And we don't short here, so it's always an interest of mine. It's an intellectual curiosity. I've made a lot of money on the short side, but due to running a retail portfolio, especially in markets like these, I just don't think it's prudent. But it's a fascinating thing for me. The other thing I think is in a market like this, I think that you may possibly have more short targets in this market than any market before, and that's a completely objective way to look at it. There's no way to definitively know that. I'm just saying, when you see as much nonsense and as many crazy valuations going on, you kind of know that if you're a short seller, you're probably in a target rich environment, right? But the interesting thing about it, like I said, is to me what's going on with tech. And the fact that this sideways motion now for the NASDAQ, and guys, this is by far the longest period of time. We'd have to go back and look at the dip in March and how quick it took it for the NASDAQ to recover. But you're right up there now on the longest period of time. If I pull the chart up on the NASDAQ here, and guys, just again, so why are we focused on the NASDAQ? Because it's the index that's driven this entire thing, right? This has been a tech rally through and through, and the whole market has been that way. But let's see here. You've basically had you hit the all-time high on February 16th here. And you're now trading below that. You took some sharp hammers down there when tech was getting hammered. You climbed all the way back, basically up to that previous level. And then you failed again. You failed again. So, I mean, what is that? You're looking at 1, 2, 3. You're looking at a 3-month sideways process with no new highs, and I'd have to look back through the data, but I don't think we've gone through a stretch like this on the NASDAQ in this entire cycle, right? Go dating clear back to the financial crisis, and I could be wrong. Like I said, it's possible that you spent more than 3 or 4 months below the previous all-time high, but not really in this way. And the other thing, too, is that so many of those momentum plays are falling out of bed. Peloton got waxed. Let's see. Peloton was down what? Jeez, what was it down? 20% today? So many of these high flyers. Tesla continues to be under pressure. The tape on that just does not look good. Like I said, ARK is back down to its previous lows. or right around there. ARC looks to be in trouble again. You'll have to see the way that plays out. Like I said, there's no knowing, right? The other interesting thing I think about that is that the NASDAQ and tech has come under pressure again, and you haven't seen that subsequent pop in yields that everybody was attributing that pullback in the NASDAQ to in the high-valued names. You're still at a 1.56 on the 10-year bond. So one of the things I was kind of thinking about is if you see those yields start popping again into this tape, you could see that bloodletting still in the NASDAQ that we've been talking about for the last 2 months, right? That pattern of just jumping up to those previous all-time highs and just not being able to break through them. Now, the interesting thing that we've seen, and like I was telling the people in the warm-up, on the value side of things, at least in our value portfolio, it's quite the opposite. This week was a breakout week for us. I think the value portfolio was up 6% this week alone. Now, we're recording the show on Thursday, so we obviously got to see where we end. But we set a high watermark on the year, so the value portfolio has broken out significantly to a new high. Prior to this week, I think we were up 30.5%. As it sits today, I think the value portfolio is up like 32.5% so far this year in 2021. Now, I'm not citing that performance, guys, to brag. I'm not citing the performance varies depending on the size of your account. There's a lot of caveats that come with that, okay? When you started with us, that's from January 1 of this year. I'm using it more of a proxy on the value side, right? That's really what I'm paying attention to, and that's why I think it's important, because that our value portfolio is overwhelmingly in value plays, things that are deeply undervalued. So I think it's a great proxy to look at as it relates to the entire market. And the fact that the market itself did not set new all-time highs, that grinded slightly negative this week, and yet that value side, it looks like a definitive breakout. Again, you know, the previous high water mark at 30.5%, and you're well than 2% above it. Again, got to see if you hold through. But the parts of it that are encouraging to me are energy. Energy continues to rally. You had a pullback and some consolidation over the last 2 months, and we've been telling you for months that we were expecting that. I was shocked that it took as long as it did. The uranium stuff has broken out. Uranium has broken out. Had me a little worried. We, again, got to see if it's confirmed. But, you know, we've got some individual names that we hold that are related to the uranium side of things, or uranium miners that we hold. A couple of those are not at new all-time highs, but the uranium fund, URNM, broke out to new significant highs. And that's really bullish. Man, the inflation signals are showing up all over the place. Another one that's really interesting, and this is not for the faint of heart, but coal. Right, talk about an unpopular thing to be or pushing right now, and I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying we've seen some really big moves in coal names this week. A couple, one in particular that we owned, which was a big recommendation from us from our favorite macro analyst Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. He was really slamming the table, and he just told me definitively. And we'd been watching it for a while, but he just told me definitively, now's the time to go on Peabody Energy, a coal company. And, so we did our own flight check, right? Went through our process, and then we pulled the trigger on that. And you guys know Chase, if you listen to the show, he's not one who's given to hyperbole at all. He's always has two feet on the ground. He is very, and we pay him a retainer. He's our macro analyst. He doesn't work for us, but he's on contract. Because he's so good. And again, he's not given to hyperbole. He's not going to, talk above his pay grade or any of that kind of stuff. It's not the kind of guy he is. And he was just very resoundingly firm. Zach, you got to get in there. This coal thing's going to run. We took substantial positions in it late last week. I want to say Thursday or Friday. We're already up like 35%. I think what you're dealing with here, guys, is the new reality. People staring at the economies coming online in a way that is very unfamiliar, right? It's not a slow acceleration. There's so much dry powder out there. There's so much liquidity. So things are opening with force. You see a lot of inflationary pressures built up, some due to COVID, some due to money printing, some a combination of the two. The lumber situation is a classic example. We're going to get more into that in the next segment. Speaking of which, we're going to do a two-segment market update because there's so much to talk about. So we're going to cut it off right here, Going to take a quick break. As always, you can call us 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. You guys know the drill. Radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Sign up for the podcast so you get automatic updates. Anyway, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back to continue the market update, and then we're also going to jump into the inflationary topic because I think it's the most important out there. So stick with us through the break. We'll be right back. This is the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
How do you know your finances and investments right now in today's economy are positioned for a successful retirement? Join me at Zach Abraham's Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow, Thursday, May 27th. Zach, I'm excited to be there. Tell us what to expect.
Dory, we've taken Bulwark's entire investment and retirement planning process, the same one you and Suzanne went through, and we've condensed it down into a 30-minute class. We'll answer all the big questions. Do you need estate planning? Long-term care? When should you take Social Security? How much money do you need to retire? And we're also going to show everyone who attends how to protect their portfolio against loss while still growing their assets.
Join me at the Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow with Zach Abraham, Thursday, May 27th, right after my show at 3. Sign up now at knowyourriskradio.com. You'll get a free copy of Zach's booklet, Common Sense Investing. Space is limited for this free live webinar. Reserve your spot now at knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement with a firm's license to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. All right. So picking back up about what we were talking about the lumber situation currently being a classic inflationary example, what do we mean by that? So first of all, inflation... And we've talked about this on the show. Inflation is a much more complex situation than most people think. And what I mean by that is that it can be easily confused. The way that we think about it in lay terms, right? The average person out there, including yours truly at one point in my life and career, is currency valuation drops, therefore everything gets more expensive. That is a very crude, one-size-fits-all approach. It's not wrong. It's just a very crude, one-size-fits-all approach. Another thing that can create what appears to be inflation are supply constraints, right? And I think there's an aspect to lumber about that right now. And for those of you that don't know, and I don't know what the historic – I don't even know how they price that out. But in terms of units of raw lumber sold – you know, I think that long-term average price is somewhere like around $150 to $250 bucks. Don't quote me. But in coming right out of the coronavirus issue, it got a lot of traction because the price of lumber spiked up to like $850 bucks. And we were like, that's nosebleed. There's no way you can sustain it. Well, it spiked again, and now it's $1,500, almost $1,600 bucks. It's crazy. I got a buddy of mine that's in the construction business, and they're doing an apartment complex. And the cost of his lumber package in the last month went from, or the last 2 months or something like that, went from $500,000 to $1 million bucks. That's the difference it made, right? But when you look deeper into the lumber scenario, you know, and the inflationistas out there, the people that are saying the dollar's falling and it's happening right now and we're going to be Venezuela inside of 16 months, they're pointing to lumber. And you guys know my thoughts on currency valuations and the government printing the way they are and the long-term impacts. I'm not throwing water on that, right? I'm just saying we're not going to be Venezuela in 16 months. That the truth, right, once again, lies somewhere in the middle. But lumber is a classic example because lumber is kind of a combination. And this is why I don't think you're going to see lumber prices pull right back down. Lumber is kind of a confluence of several different things that typically get blamed for inflation. So, right, the amount of money that the government has pumped out there and the suppression of mortgage rates are absolutely playing into the demand for lumber, right? Think about people taking stimulus checks to build a back deck. Perfect example, right? So there's no question that those actions in a classic inflationary way, that increase of capital is driving up prices, okay? There's that aspect of it. COVID is also another big aspect of it. They had to shut down lumber mills, right? So at the same time that you're doing things that are increasing demand, you did things that drastically reduced supply. So that was an impetus to the price. But one of the other aspects to the lumber situation right now that most people don't realize is really the last 10 to 12 years. And I dug in this with this same buddy of mine, Alex. Shout out to Alex. Hope you're doing well out there, pal. It was fun the other night hanging out. But anyway, Alex and I were having a conversation about this and and prompted me to dig deeper into it as well. And lumber is a really interesting situation because coming out of the real estate crisis that led, right, the financial crisis, real estate crisis, but going into that, we obviously had an incredible housing boom. And lumber prices were robust, obviously, and new mills had been opened up. And then the financial crisis happened. And even though we've recovered now in terms of price and house demand is crazy, it hadn't been for the vast majority of the recovery. So some of those mills didn't reopen. Some of those mills were, you know, run at part capacity, right? And just because the demand wasn't there, they're not going to operate the mill at a loss. It's kind of a similar situation we see going on in the uranium markets, right? They've shut down uranium mines. Supply is getting really tight. And then also you had environmental impacts, which was, you know, if you look globally, one of the narratives out there, and again, this is just looking at the data. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm not saying that there isn't climate change. I'm not saying that things are getting warmer. I'm just citing facts. Okay, there's a big misnomer out there that global warming is leading to a bunch of new wildfires. That's just not true. There is not an increase. The number, even over the last 10 years, globally speaking, wildfire severity and the number of them, it's flat. It hasn't gone down. It hasn't gone up. That's just the data. Okay. But they've been more concentrated on the West Coast. And in just by happenstance, typically areas where a good chunk of lumber comes out of. And so increased wildfires in those areas has also pinched supply. So when you look at lumber, are there classic inflationary currency depreciation type aspects of it? Yes. But there are also environmental aspects, right? And when I mean environmental, I'm not just talking about the environment, but just the sector, the environment that the economy is currently operating in. And I because of that, I think it's really important that people understand what is going on in lumber markets. And the interesting thing about it is that because of those confluence of events, think about it. That shortage of lumber and that expense of lumber is going to extend out because people can't do the jobs that they want to do. They can't get the lumber. So that should sustain the demand, right? People that would like, you know, people that would want to build that deck this summer, they may not be able to start it till November or December. So what I'm saying is it's going to increase that demand curve out further, right? This rush or this push for lumber will be extended to some degree. How much, how long? I don't know, but it will be. And you can't just turn around and jump the supply up because it takes a while to grow trees. It also takes capital and it takes time to open up new mills or retool mills. And this is another aspect where I say, you know, again, and maybe the outcome isn't the same, but I'm just saying at this point from where we sit, this period of time, economically speaking, is very reminiscent to me of the late 60s to the early 80s. And the reason I think that's so important is that let's get back into the classic retirement portfolio, ride the market up and down. Look, the average retirement lasts 20 years. If I'm right, and this is a period of time like 1968 to 1983, where inflation ripped, right? Commodity prices skyrocketed, market made a round trip and went nowhere for 15 years. If you believe me that you think that we're entering an inflationary environment and it's reminiscent of that period of time, then what in the world are you doing in a portfolio where the answer is to buy and hold? If I'm right and that occurs, then owning a portfolio like that over the next 10 to 12 years is going to wreck you. And I don't think it's a good idea anytime, but it's going to wreck you. Now, if you had sell discipline, if you had rules, if you had a momentum algorithmic strategy like we do, and a value portfolio that is going to, you know, as long as we see these things going on, is going to pivot toward inflationary things, you know, inflationary assets, then that same period of time where the portfolio you're in makes a round trip over 12 to 15 years and you don't go anywhere, a portfolio that's managed actively like ours could blow it out. You know, so once again, guys, you know, one of the reasons we want to do this show, obviously, like I've said before, we want to get new clients. But the other thing is we want to educate people. We want to look at them and say, look right now, look at the gift you've been given. Look at this rebound in markets that shouldn't have happened, right? This crazy stimulus. The pain that you felt last March got squared away so quickly, but learn the lesson from that. I know there's so many of you out there that got flat-footed, probably sat there and thought, you know, I knew it couldn't last forever, and yet I stayed in there too long. And, you know, because it looked like that. We were down 36, down almost 40% there. It looked like it was just going to keep rolling, right? So take the lesson from that. And that's what's so crazy, that sometimes even people go, what do you mean frustrating, Zach? Your guys' firm has grown so much. And it has. But we legitimately care about the outcomes of you guys. We legitimately are passionate about there's a better way to do it. And the thing that's so frustrating is the reason that people don't, well, A, because maybe they don't trust you, trust me, and I get that, right? You don't know me. But the other aspect of it, there's this misnomer that if we do that, we're going to miss out on all the growth. No, your results are going to be better. When we say we're going to lower your fees, drastically lower your risk, and give you a lot more upside, that's why you need to call us. I got to be careful talking about performance on the radio because I don't want to be misleading. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to make it sound like we're the only perfect people that don't make mistakes. We do. We just make sure those mistakes don't ruin our clients' retirement. And when we do that correctly, that is why our portfolios on all levels have smoked the market over the past year and a half. Well, over longer than that. But, you know, it was most, you know, you could have done great in 18 and 19. And if you didn't manage 2020 right, it all went out the window, which is why risk management is so important. And you know, low interest rates like we currently have, they come with their own problems, but they also come with opportunities. And one of them is there's a lot of safer asset classes like our bond replacement strategy where you're not paying a fee, you're insured against loss, and you're still averaging 5 to 6.5% a year. Doing one with a client last night. Clients owned our bond replacement strategy for 2.5 years, started with 135 grand. He's up to 164,000. And that's been one of our worst performers. But still, go compare those numbers. He did all of that. He made that money. That, what is that, 18% return or something like that? Over 2.5 years, not risking a dime of his capital and not paying a fee. Your bond portfolio isn't even doing half of that. I guarantee it. And you're taking more risk. That bond portfolio was down 20% in March. Anyway, for time constraints, we got to go, guys. But you know, watching the performance again and the value portfolio now up 34% on the year, just sitting there going, there's a better way to do this. And that value portfolio was down 13 last March when the market was down 36. There's a better way to do it. There's a better answer for your bonds. There's a better answer for your stocks. And you can do it all at less price. Save money on fees. Actually have somebody watching your money. Anyway, you guys know the drill. We got to go due to time constraints. Stick around, though. Interview's coming up next. And you can enjoy it. Really sharp guy, Edwin Dorsey, sharp young analyst. Anyway, we got to run. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK. And 866-779-RISK. Take the 3 minutes to invest in your future and just inform yourself about other possibilities and other ways of doing it. Anyway, got to run. We'll be back right after the break. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
How do you know your finances and investments right now in this economy are positioned for a successful retirement? Well, you can join me at Zach Abraham's Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow, Thursday, May 27th, right after my show. Zach, now's the time for everyone to take a hard look at their investment strategy.
Dory, there could not be a more prescient time. I'll answer all the big questions on investors' minds because I can promise you if you're incorporating some of the long-running investment strategies in today's markets, like a basic 60-40 stock bond portfolio, you're taking a serious gamble, and now is not the time to be gambling your retirement.
Learn all about Zach's retirement planning and investment strategies at his Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow, Thursday, May 27th. I'll be there too, right after my show at 3 o'clock. Space is limited for this free live webinar. Make your reservation now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm is licensed to conduct business. Borough Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. All right. So this is a segment. I've been meaning to do this for a while now. And before we get started, I want to mention it again because we haven't done it. And so if you guys have... If anybody out there has something you'd like to hear us discuss or specific questions, obviously, like, you know, not what stock to buy and do I buy or sell this, but, you know, about our investment philosophy, trading questions, I can't promise you I'll give you the best answer, but I'm more than willing to share our approach. And a listener reached out to me via Twitter and asked about, and I thought it was a great question, asked about selling discipline. And I know that there's probably a lot of you going, selling discipline? What are you talking about? So often in investing, and this is true of media, it's true of the people giving the answers, it's true of the people asking the questions. In my opinion, there's this big misnomer that it's all about buying the right stock or it's about buying the right thing. I actually think the key to investing is knowing when to sell. And I think that's decidedly harder. And the reason I say that is twofold. A, if a stock doesn't work, right, or you lose money on a stock, how do you know when to throw in the towel and admit that you've made a mistake versus saying, hey, it's, you know, I got to take advantage of this opportunity and I got to buy more. And that's, that is a key question. And I think an example of that today, and again, I don't mean to pick on them, but it's a stock everybody knows. Tesla's an example, right? Tesla's, what is it, 30% off its all-time highs. Now, you guys know what my thoughts are, but let's assume that we don't have those thoughts. If you're a Tesla investor and you're looking at it, you know, and if you're an honest, intellectually honest Tesla investor, you could admit that the stock is extraordinarily expensive. You may feel that's justified and you may end up being right. But here's the quandary. What do you do with that stock right now at present? Do you wave the white flag and sell it? Yeah, I know a lot of the Tesla fanboys will sit there and go, no, you buy more. Right, but like every company, that will be the wrong decision at some point. Right, I mean, it just is. Every company will peak. Oh, Tesla's too early on. Look, again, we're not talking about Tesla. We're talking about selling discipline. We're talking about trading. We're talking about what are your rules? How do you do things? And I think one of the biggest dangers that investors face is, and I get it. When I started in the industry, I was much the same way. You think binary. You think, is this a good investment or is it not a good investment? Do I want to buy it or do I want to avoid it? There's so much more nuance. And that sterile black and white view of investing, it's just not accurate. It's just not. Right? And one of the ways we express the gray aspects of investing is through position sizing. That's another thing we teach our clients. Just because something is really risky doesn't mean it's not appropriate even for a retirement portfolio. The way you make it appropriate is by sizing it correctly. It was like when we bought Bitcoin for our clients. They had about a 1.5% allocation to it. And bought it around 14,500, high 14,000s, I want to say. And what we did, knowing that it's a very volatile, risky investment, when it doubled, we sold half. And now, Our clients have an investment in crypto that they didn't pay for. It's not their capital. Right now, we've trimmed more and things of that nature. But so all of this is cueing to the fact that investments are made when they're sold, right? That's when you realize the gain from an investment. That's when you know whether it was good or bad. And yet so little focus is put on selling. So I will address that listener's question. As a reminder, if you have questions like that, like I said, you can reach out to me on Twitter. You can shoot me a DM. You can email us at Bulwark's email, which you can find at bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. And I'd be happy to do a segment on topics that you guys find interesting. So here's how we do it. First of all, I think we need to delineate between the two stock portfolios we have, right? We don't have to make those decisions in the algorithmic portfolio. And guys, that's one of the reasons it's valuable, right? It's not influenced by human emotions. It's not influenced by up and, you know, it doesn't freak out and go, oh, we bought or sold the wrong stock, right? It adheres to rules. It does it the same every single time. As long as that stock fits the computer's definition of momentum, it keeps it. The minute the price breaks down to a point where it doesn't fit the computer's momentum, and that changes. I remember the algorithm back in March, in the melee in March, bought Teladoc. That was a really popular, it was like, you know, Zoom with doctors, right? And so obviously a big winner in the pandemic, did very well. Bought it at like 103 in 2 weeks or three, whatever it was, some ridiculous period of time. Bought it at 103 and it was up to like 205. And, you know, you guys know me, we're in the middle of the pandemic. Things are still very up in the air. I don't think anybody at that point was betting that we'd see new all-time highs in the next 7 months. But, and then Teladoc started to fall. And I remember having a conversation with Marcos, the guy that runs the algorithmic portfolio, and saying, hey, why isn't the computer taking profits on this thing? You know, we just doubled up our money in like 3 weeks in the middle of a pandemic. You know, we need to ring the register. And he just said, let the computer do what it does. So the computer let that thing drop all the way down. We got it at 103, wrote it up to 205. The computer let that thing drop all the way down to like 168. And I was freaking out, but Marcos looked at me and he goes, Zach, you know, the stock has doubled in this period of 3 weeks. When a stock does that, you're going to see some consolidation just from people taking profits. So the computer cuts it a wider berth. Now the computer was dead right because then Teladoc reversed and went back up to $220 and it sold it around there. So my whole point is the selling aspect of the algorithm, right? When people hear about, think about it, when people hear about the algorithm, they think they're impressed by the gains it's made, and it's made a lot. I mean, it's thrashed the market over the last 2.5 years. But more importantly, right, which you guys know if you're listening, it was down 8.5% in March when the market was down 36. Why? Because of selling, because of the selling rules, which is why Marcos built it that way. So the selling side of that algorithm is every bit more as important as what it's buying. And truthfully, in terms of its performance over the last 16 months, the selling aspect of the algorithm is the biggest driver of its outperformance. And that's the thing I don't think people realize, right? So that's how the algorithm works. Now, on the value side, it's a different approach because it's human beings running it. But do we have rules? Absolutely. The first rule right out of the gate that we talk about that our guys know inside and out and that I'm hammering on all the time and that our analysts know, as we talk about it, and usually the first thing to discuss is this, and I'll tell you in a second. And if it's not discussed right out of the gate, I quickly bring it up and go, hold on a second, back up. And what is that? Is this a trade or an investment? Is this a trade or an investment? What do I mean by that? For us, now remember, part of our process and part of you know, the rules that we have set up, it reflects the fact that we manage other people's money and we are risk managers, right? So, you know, maybe people at home, if you're more of a swashbuckling trader, maybe this doesn't work for you, this exact process, but I do believe a process like this should be good for everybody. So is it a trade or an investment? Now, why is that important? If it's an investment and it goes down by 20%, I should be ready to buy more, assuming that something hasn't changed, right? And I don't mean by changed a disappointing quarter that makes the stock sell off by 20%. If it's an investment, it's something that we really believe in current market conditions at current price levels. And if we don't, if we look at it and go, okay, if this thing drops 20%, if I'm researching this stock and I really believe it's a buy for, you know, all of my fundamental reasons, it's good value, good management, right? It meets all of our criteria. I always ask myself when I'm looking at those stocks, what would I do if this drops 20%? And if I don't immediately feel comfortable that I'd buy more, what it tells me is that I haven't researched the company enough. Right? That's what it tells me. And so that part of it's a warning. And I know that I need to do some more work. I need to get myself more familiar. I need to be so intimately knowledgeable of what this company is and how it works and what my expectations are that I should be able to skim through an earnings report or a conference call transcript and look at the quarterly numbers and immediately know that, something material has changed, right? This is not what I thought it was. And that's, so if that is your answer, right, that doesn't really apply to the selling rules part. Right. So I'm addressing the selling rules part of it, because if something bad happens or something unexpected happens with a company and it fundamentally changes your look on it, all rules are off. At that point, what we do is we treat it like a new investment. OK, but let's stick to the selling rules side of it. And what I mean by treating it by like a new investment is we re-research it. We re-bake that change in whatever that bad thing or that unexpected thing that's happened. We factor that into the research instead of knee-jerk just pulling a lever, right? Because let's face it, there are unexpected things that happen at businesses that can cause short-term pain, but can also bring about long-term opportunity. You know, and so you've got to treat these situations with a level of dynamism. But let's, for the sake of argument, to really focus on the selling side rules, let's assume that that's not the case. So right out of the gate, just something bad happens, it drops 20%, you should be ready to buy more. That happened with us with Camping World, right? We had a very high level of conviction on that stock. I am not recommending you buy it. I'm not recommending you sell it. I'm not even telling you if we still own it or not, right? It's not what this show's about. But go pull up the chart on Camping World. We got involved around 30, 31, I want to say. And then it made a pretty good run, like up to 38, 39. We're feeling really good about things. And then out of nowhere, it just got hammered, like back down to 33. What did we do? That was a little frustrating because we didn't think it deserved to get hammered. We bought more. I think it got down to like 32, bought a little more. Then got down to like 31, bought a little more. Why? Because we believed that we knew enough. We had researched the company enough to where we didn't see any material reason for the drop in price. And we looked at it as a sale. And that's a really important thing. And that's the difference. That should be, in my mind, the difference with an investment. You know it so well, you're really like an owner of the company. You're like, oh, these people are overreacting to that. I know the way that works. And I know that this really is only going to disrupt them for another quarter. This is an opportunity, right? That's an investment. So how you get in and out of those is much more nuanced. But bottom line is, the other point, the vast majority of retail investors, I'm not bagging on you if you do this, but the vast majority of retail investors don't do enough homework to double down, to buy more when it goes down. Now, that's not to say they won't, right? They will. And usually think they're smart when they're doing it. But that's because they're conflating a trade with an investment. And what do I mean by that? If they didn't do the fundamental research, then by definition, it's a trade, because why are they buying that stock? They'll tell you it's because it's a good company, but it's not. They're buying the stock because they think it's going to go up. Okay, so if that's the premise you're buying a stock, think about it. Logically, you should have an exit point, because what happens if it doesn't do what you think it's going to do? Well, yeah, but it won't go down much. How do you know? You haven't done the fundamental research. You're buying it because Jimmy, who sits next to you at work, told you it was a great stock. So you might tell yourself you're buying it because it's a great company, but you're not. Yeah, when people ask you for a hot stock tip, you ever notice they don't ask you about the balance sheet or the cash flow statement, right? Tell me what's going to go up. And that's fine. There's guys that have run their whole careers like that, but they have a ton of selling discipline. Okay, so that's part of my question about asking, is this an investment or is this a trade? If it's a trade, our guys know inherently, if it's a trade, we preset how much we are willing to lose on that trade. We have hard rules. Maybe we think it's got a big enough opportunity to what we will accept as much as 10 or 15% downside. And then people go, well, yeah, but Zach, what if you do that and then it drops 15% and you sell it and then it bounces right back? That happens. Here's why we believe, and the numbers bear it out, and the data, that's still a better approach. If you have rules on those things, and like I said, guys, there are people that apply these rules that do the fundamental research and still use those sell rules. Why do they do it? It's the same reason we do risk management. You will lose on some. You will sell some right at the bottom and they'll turn around and go back up. But you know what you won't have happen? You won't have 50, 60, and 70% losses. You'll have wins. You even by accident, think of how many people have thrown money at the market in the last year and have made tons of dough. Right? You'll have wins. The key to investing is minimizing and shrinking your losses. That's why we're pounding on risk management constantly. And that's why we pound the table so aggressively for the way we do it as it relates to retirement portfolios. Because if we're 35 or 40 years old, what are we trying to do? We're trying to maximize our gains. And we should have a big stomach for risk, meaning that some of the biggest paying investments have the biggest level of volatility. So volatility is our friend. Once we go into retirement, guys, that game changes. We are relying on that money right now to provide our income. So what does that mean? That means that every aspect of your portfolio should have some type of loss prevention structure. You look at the vast majority of you guys out there, you have none. None. And you talk to your advisor, ride it up and down. You just got to ride it up and down. Well, what if we are entering, like I said, I think the period of time that we're entering is very, very similar, very like the 1970s. I think that we're kind of like at 1968, 1969 right now. And what happened from 1968 to 1983? The stock market went nowhere for 15 years. Having sell rules during the 70s would have, even if you were just playing the index, would have been the difference between making nothing over 15 years and making money. Right? Just the sell rules alone. Because it would have kept you from taking the full hits of all those dips, right? Because the market wasn't straight and flat during the 70s. Right, it was violent up and down. It just round tripped and went nowhere. So that's the other part of it. Those sell rules make it possible to make money in a market that just goes up and down and doesn't really go anywhere. But the biggest aspect of it is, like I said, if you avoid the blowups, if you avoid the big wrecks, that will be a performance juicer in and of itself. That will improve performance. And so having that discipline to first of all know, is this a trade or is this an investment? And then having the self-awareness and the intellectual honesty to admit it's not an investment because I haven't done enough work. So if it's not an investment, can I still buy the stock? Absolutely, but you got to have rules. And I believe you have to have rules to the upside, at least for the amount of capital you've put in. And what I mean by that is exactly what we did with Bitcoin. Our rule going into it was the minute we double up, we will remove our capital. What we do from there, we'll ride it and trade it and treat it like any other trade. We'll try to read the markets. Hopefully we get it right. If we don't, but we can do that then because we're playing with house money. Our own capital isn't at risk. Same with GameStop. Now, GameStop, we sold it all. Right? But when we bought GameStop at $11 last October, before it ever showed up on Wall Street Bets or anything like that, when we bought it, we had an exit price of $40. A mandatory sell at 40. So we did. Bought it at 11. By the time we filled the order, it was actually at 42. Why? Because it was a trade. Right? And that, and I think trade or investment is, guys, it saved me so much money and is such a big part of our value portfolio. Because when you do that, look, it, like I said, there are times where it's not going to work out well, where you're like, man, I should have just held it, or I should have just bought more. Right? But what you will not have happen is you will not have the permanent impairment of capital, or not very much anyway. And what I mean by that is when you get down 60 or 70% in the stock, it's an awful place to be because you've got no good choices, right? Your choices are A, to sell it, admit you were wrong, and memorialize that loss. Right? Now, you can invest that remaining capital and build it back up and make up for it. But essentially, that's permanently impaired capital, right? You've got nothing but bad choices around you. Or the other thing that you do is you look at it and go, man, we're down 20%. I'm going to buy more. But now what are you doing potentially? You're potentially throwing good money after bad. And then obviously there's the performance aspect of it, which, you know, if you guys haven't gotten that, you know, I'm really trying to explain that to people. It really is unfortunate that most people don't understand the math. But if you lose your, if you avoid big losses, your performance will be better. And I don't really care what stocks you pick. It just will. It's the easiest way to juice your performance is to limit losses and downturns. And how do you do that? By rules. Avoid the big hits. That's the algorithm, right? You look at the algorithm. It is the basis. Again, the sell rules, the sell discipline is the basis or the foundation for the algorithm's success. That's why it's thrashed the market. That's why the algorithmic portfolio is up. Don't quote me, but I want to say now you're looking at like 87% in the last 2.5 years, beating the market by like plus 25. Right? It's the sell rules. And it's the part of investing that nobody thinks about. It's give me the hot stock tip, and I want to look at them and go, when are you going to sell it? Yeah, maybe it doubles or triples, but if you hold it and it goes back down to where it was, it didn't do anything for you. It's a wild ride, but you didn't go anywhere. And this feeds right back into our philosophy about retirement. The average retirement portfolio has no sell side rules. As a matter of fact, they sell you as that's part of their perk. We're just going to buy it and hold it. And like I said, if that's your thing, right? If you can stomach the type of volatility and the type of downside hits that come with that approach, then more power to you. Just don't pay somebody to do it. You know, you go 50% SPY, 30% triple Q, and 20% IWM, and just let it roll. And I'm not dogging on that approach. That would be far better than the portfolio you're currently paying your advisor at Morgan Stanley to manage for 1%. No knock on Morgan Stanley, just using them as an example. Why? Because the underlying performance of his funds that he's going to give you, they're probably not going to be better than the ones I just named. But you're going to get rid of his management fee. Why don't we think that's a good idea? Look at the history. If you have that portfolio throughout history, you better be prepared to deal with 60 to 70% downturns. That's what's happened. And if you don't like that idea, then that buy and hold strategy isn't for you. And so my question to you would be, why are you still in it? Especially if you listen to the show, especially if you know there's other ways, especially if you know there's a firm like us that uses these sell rules, that builds portfolios that are never going to be down 60 or 70%. So you're not ever going to have to deal with that. You're not going to have to go back to work. Right? Last March, when the whole thing's falling apart, and you know, it's amazing how short-term people's memories are, because I think a lot of people have already forgotten the pain. Why? Because markets went back up. And their accounts at new highs. So that's where the analysis stops. But put yourself back in that moment. What did we feel like? We thought the whole thing was falling apart. We didn't know if our job was going to be there. We didn't know if we're going to be able to keep our house. We didn't know if people all around us were going to start dying. And then on top of it, we look at our investment portfolio and we're down almost 40%. right? It doesn't fix everything, but wouldn't you have much rather looked at your investment portfolio and seen you were down five and that the bleeding had already stopped? Well, it's one less thing to worry about, right? Kind of took that concern off the table. And then on top of it, that's what's driven the outperformance. As of after today, the value portfolio is pushing 34% on the year. And I'm recording this segment on Friday, by the way. I came back in because I didn't get everything I wanted to yesterday. I recorded the majority of the show yesterday, but finishing up these segments today. But value portfolio is up almost 34% on the year. S&P's up, what, 11? And it's not up because we're geniuses and we picked. The number one reason why it's up is because we didn't lose in March. And we were able to buy things when other people were just holding on and quote unquote riding it out. Right? That's the power of risk management. And it feeds right into these selling rules and these selling disciplines and avoiding the big losses. And if you're an investor, those rules will help you. If you're a trader, those rules will help. If you're a trader, those rules are absolutely essential. And I think they're essential, especially in these times. Right? I mean, and why I say especially these times is everybody should be caught, whether you think the market's going to go up, market's going to go down. Everybody should know that we're in a very bizarre place historically, and that anytime market valuations have gotten this high, you have had a catastrophic drop at some point in the next couple of years. Every single time, without fail. Now, I'm not saying that that is guaranteed to happen again, but how big of an idiot would you feel if you're a year and a half, 2 years from now, looking at 60, 70% portfolio losses, and you realize that I was hoping this is the one time in history where it didn't play out that way. You know, just think about that. You'd want to kill yourself. You're like, it's so stupid. I knew the history. I was listening to that schmuck on Know Your Risk Radio. I knew the risks I was taking it, and I stayed here and took it on the chin because I didn't have sell discipline. I didn't have risk management. And on top of that, had I listened to that schmuck on the radio, I'd have made more money over the last 2 years and avoided the 70% loss. Guys, there's a better way to do this. Don't you want this kind of thinking in your retirement portfolio? Don't you want the person that's managing your money to sit there and know that they're at the helm and know that they're going to block, right? That they're going to protect capital, that you're not paying them just to ride it up and down? I mean, say that out loud. It sounds ridiculous. So quit sitting around and talking about it. Call us. And if it's not to avoid the big losses, do it to make more money. I was telling one of our new advisors that the other day. I was like, you need to be passionate about what we do. Right? We have a message that is going to help people, that's going to save people a lot of money. And oh, by the way, make them more in the process. And I said, you can't expect them to be excited about what we do unless you are. And we're delivering the goods here. This is real. And if that tweaks you, if that reminds you, if you're sitting there going, you know, I know that my bonds are killing me. I know they aren't paying anything. I know this market's insane. I know I should be thinking about risk management. I know I should be, this is when everybody's getting crazy, this is when I should be focused on the disciplined aspect to make sure that I'm not chasing ridiculous things and compromising my financial future because I'm looking short term. If that's a realization you've come to, then guys, good. But take some action now. Take the 3 minutes it requires. 3 minutes to call us, 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK. That doesn't guarantee you're going to be a client. We don't twist your arm. We give you the Common Sense Investing booklet. If you want to have a chat with me, we do it. We review your current portfolio, compare it to ours, show you what our costs, and we show you. This is how we save you money. Here's your fee versus the one you have. Here's our performance versus the portfolio you currently have. Both in the ups and down markets. Which one would you rather have? Most of the time, people become clients. If they don't, shake their hands, walk, send them the other way. But it's worth 3 minutes of your time. It's only your entire financial future. It's only the money you've worked your entire life for. So inform yourself. Like I said, if nothing else, you know, you'll know a new way. So give us a call, 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. And if there is a topic like this that you'd like us to discuss in a long-form format like that, You can send us an email. You can call us. You can follow me on Twitter at KYR Radio and shoot me a DM or tweet me directly or whatever the case may be. Anyway, we got to run. We got the interview coming up. Stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
How do you know your finances and investments right now in today's economy are positioned for a successful retirement? Join me at Zach Abraham's Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow, Thursday, May 27th. Zach, I'm excited to be there. Tell us what to expect.
Dory, we've taken Bulwark's entire investment and retirement planning process, the same one you and Suzanne went through, and we've condensed it down into a 30-minute class. We'll answer all the big questions. Do you need estate planning? Long-term care? When should you take Social Security? How much money do you need to retire? And we're also going to show everyone who attends how to protect their portfolio against loss while still growing their assets.
Join me at the Know Your Risk Virtual Roadshow with Zach Abraham, Thursday, May 27th, right after my show at 3. Sign up now at knowyourriskradio.com. You'll get a free copy of Zach's booklet, Common Sense Investing. Space is limited for this free live webinar. Reserve your spot now at knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement with a firm's license to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Have you heard? Beginning next year, all W-2 employees in our state will be taxed for long-term care, but not if you have an existing plan in place. The new government program will make Washington State employees pay for a long-term care plan through a new payroll tax. You won't have a choice, and you won't be able to opt out unless you have an existing plan in place, like my wife and I do, through 525 Advisors. Learn about this new payroll tax and new long-term care plans at a free live webinar this Wednesday at 3 p.m. Long-term care is such an important part of retirement planning. A good long-term care plan from 525 Advisors can make sure your care is funded and managed when you need it, protecting your loved ones and everything you've worked so hard for. They also have plans that pay you back if you never need it. I recommend looking into it now because most people can get better coverage for less than what that mandatory tax will be. So attend the free live webinar this Wednesday at 3 p.m. Register now at 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And it's time again for my favorite part of the show, the interview. And we're bringing another great one. There's two great interviews in a row. And our guest today, this is his second time on the show. But I personally think, and he wasn't on that long ago, but I think that his work in particular is really appropriate right now. It's very prescient, if you will, in my opinion. And I think the things he's focused on and his work is going to be even more relevant in the near future. Now, I could certainly be wrong. And, you know, there's no point in me going on about it. We should just get it from directly from the horse's mouth. So anyway, without further ado, I want to welcome back Edwin Dorsey to the show. Edwin, how you doing?
Zach, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
Hey, no problem, man. And we were laughing afterwards because you are by far, now I'm guesstimating on the age and you don't need to say, but you're by far the youngest guest we've ever had on. And now a two-timer. So hopefully as you get older, you'll get better. You'll develop a better taste in which invites to podcasts you accept. So anyway, hey, pal. So wanted to just kind of start from a global basis. And then, you know, I've been watching your feed here, and then I've got several specific things that you've posted about and things that you've got your eye on, but why don't we take it from you? What are you focused the most on right now What is catching your eye the most, whether it's with individual securities or as the market as a whole? I think we both can agree there's a lot of interesting action. Maybe also include an update on ARK, because I think everybody just naturally assumed that, that was just a scare and ARK's off to the races again. That chart looks to be breaking down again. So anyway, maybe an update on that. But the global feed, what Edwin is looking at and what's really got your attention?
So, Zach, I'm always looking to find bad companies or companies that are misleading investors or misleading customers. Naturally, I've been spending a lot of time looking at SPACs because those tend to attract a lot of low-quality companies. One company that I wrote about today is Canoe, an electric vehicle company where the general counsel, CEO, CFO, all resigned within 3 months of the company going public. So those are the types of companies I'm looking for. I'm also looking a lot in the payment space. I think there's a lot of companies that are representing themselves to be like innovative payments company, trying to like piggyback on the high valuation of Stripe and Aiden and a lot of these cool payments companies, when in reality, they're just really high risk payment providers that'll go away once the market settles down. As far as ARK goes, last time I was on, we were talking about potential liquidity issues with ARK, where if ARK ever faced significant outflows, they could be in trouble because then they'd need to sell a lot of their holdings, many of which are illiquid, which would drive down the price of those holdings, which could make performance deteriorate more, which could lead to more outflows, and which could start this death spiral. And what's been bad for ARK is now, over the last 2-3 months, they've had consistent underperformance, underperforming the market by like 20 or 30%. And I think the longer you outperform, the more likely it is that you start to lose the retail base and get outflow. So I think the liquidity problems are still very real. One figure I read is that 40% of ARK's assets are in companies where they own 10% or more of the company, which means if they ever needed to sell those stakes, the prices would really move against them. So that's where I stand on ARK. And then separately, I also recently announced a job board, bullpencareers.com, where people can post jobs to hire young talent. So I've got a lot on my plate, but those are some of the projects I've been working on.
Yeah, no, I saw that job board thing, and I thought that was a really innovative idea. And especially, and it's, Edwin, I got to tell you, it's something that that I'm going to be looking at, because when you run a firm our size, it's running into people via, several of my hires. I think three people that work with or for me, I met via Twitter, which is pretty amazing. You know what I mean? And I think it's a phenomenal way to connect people because it gives you the opportunity. And I realize it's a jobs board, but you can check in there and connect via Twitter and things like that. And, I thought that was a really cool idea, and it was something where I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a look at that. The next time we got a role to fill or we're looking for something, I think that's a great place to start,
Yeah, absolutely, Zach. And you're the type of person who I think would be best suited for it, because I know tons of talented young people who are always looking to get hired, and I know tons of talented firms that are looking to hire young people.
Yeah.
So this is the way to connect the two. There are right now about 30 job postings from like DE Shaw, Point72, Citadel, but I'm really hoping it kind of evolves for a lot of the smaller employers to post jobs there, because everybody can go to Point72 website and see what's open. Not everybody knows about like the more local or niche opportunities that are out there.
I like to refer it, Edwin, as firms with tremendous upside. Right? that's the way I like to position it, right? You don't want to go to one of those big firms. They don't have as much upside as we do, right? So we're selling the growth, pal.
I like that. And I've also found that a lot of places that have like 5 employees, the interns or young people there get a lot more mentorship and attention. So the big takeaway for all your listeners is bullpencareers.com is the best place to post a job. It's completely free. It takes less than 5 minutes. And I'm trying to make it into a real thing for all finance jobs. So
super cool, man. Well, okay. So now I've got to jump back into the listeners are probably going, oh, God, here he goes. when ARK and Tesla come up. If you're fishing for me, right, throw something about Ark and Tesla on the hook, and you're going to snag me every time. Just kind of giving away my cards there. But since you and I spoke, I've been paying attention, trying honestly not to pay too much attention because I'm not involved in any of those stocks. And Ark and Tesla specifically. But one of the things that kind of caught me off guard, and I know there's a large contingent of people out there that are going to hear me say this, and they're going to say, well, yeah, no kidding, man. I don't know if you and I touched on it in the past, but I am always very careful when it comes to looking at someone that's on the other side of a trade as me, or looking at somebody who's, you know, research I disagree with, especially as I've gotten older and done this longer, I've gotten very careful about, eviscerating people like that I disagree with, and also careful about just dismissing their claims, because it's cost me sometimes, you know, and it doesn't mean that I'm not still, you know, I wouldn't hate to say cynical, but, you know, it's not to say that I'm, you know, no longer, you know, focused on reality or I guess cynical might be a fair word. I still am, but just more conscious of the fact that I can be wrong, you know, and want to be careful. But when I started paying attention to the ARK situation, now I'm making a couple assumptions here, but yeah. I'm going to assume that they're not dumb. I'm going to assume that they understand the liquidity dynamics of their portfolio. And yet I've been watching them seemingly increase their exposure to these non-liquid stocks and it at crazy valuations and made me kind of sit, you know, look at that scenario and go, look, I don't want to be a skeptic. I'm certainly not accusing anybody of anything, but it almost looked to me like they're resorting to targeting these stocks specifically because they can essentially, now with the amount of money they've got under management, they can essentially paint the tape. Do you think I'm off base? Do you think there's any validity to that? Or how do you make sense of it?
Well, Zach, I really liked your point that they are smart. I think Cathie Wood is a genuinely smart person.
Agreed.
They've massively outperformed. I don't like the takes on Twitter. Oh, they're just so stupid and lucky. No, they can be really smart. But I think even if you asked ARK, they would say, we're great at understanding technology and trends in technology and where the future is going. I think ARK is a lot weaker when it comes to specific company research and diving down into specific companies. So they know how to play a technology-based theme. They're less good at specific company research. If you look at their analysts, a lot of the analysts have backgrounds in technology, not in financial research. One example that kind of backs up my theory is that they were big investors in Wirecard as part of the fintech revolution. Now, anybody who is anybody in the hedge fund world knew Wirecard had serious issues. Basically, no real hedge fund was owning it, yet they took a big stake in it. And they wrote it all the way down as short sellers were highlighting problems over and over and over again. And it seems like they've kind of reiterated that where there's a lot of small companies making huge claims about technology. But the moment you start to do real diligence into the management, you see, there's a lot of people here who have a lot of problems. As far as understanding the liquidity problems go, I think ARK might genuinely be misunderestimating it. Tom Stout, who's like their chief operating officer, they don't have a chief risk officer, but my understanding is he's a chief operating officer. Before working at ARK, he was a radio executive at a local Lansing, Michigan radio station. Not that there's anything wrong with radio host, Zach.
No. Yeah.
He's if you look at his interviews, I think he's just been off base, and I've done a few Twitter threads explaining why I think he's wrong. Cathie Wood essentially says, we don't have a liquidity problem because it's the market makers for ARK's ETF that handle the buying and selling and not us, which is like technically true, but still means you have a liquidity problem because if a market maker is selling a lot of an illiquid stock, that stock is going to go down fast too. It doesn't really matter who's doing the selling. It's just, is there a lot of selling in an illiquid security. you know.
Here's a classic example. I don't know what to make of that statement because I refuse to believe that Kathy Wood doesn't understand the problem. Anybody that's ever touched anything under $1 billion or $2 billion, you know, anybody that's ever traded at size, and I don't care what the definition is, but if you've tried to push through a trade that was 5% or more of a company's market cap, you know what liquidity issues we're talking about, right? I don't care if it's the market maker or whatever. I just can't wrap my head around the fact that she actually doesn't see the potential issue there.
I think the other thing with ARK that might be causing them to not really take this issue seriously is that they've just had inflows every month for like the last 5 years. They've been just incredibly hot. And maybe after months and months and months of just getting billions of dollars every month, you know, it's kind of tough to visualize actually having these problems. But now it's very possible, given that they're down 30% from their February highs and they seem to be getting a little less media coverage.
They don't really have, I mean, let's be clear here. They're not really attracting, typically speaking, your classic buy and hold investor, right? We're not talking about a bunch of Buffetts that are planning on buying ARK and they're going to sit on it for the next 10 years.
That's a great point, Zach, and that's kind of what scares me. It's like very heavily retail-oriented and new investor-oriented. You know, they do a lot of podcasts and webinars, and they send these simple emails kind of trying to break down their investments. And it's very clear they're super retail and new investor-oriented. I think those can be the first to join, but also the first to leave, and they'll be very fickle in bad times. I think that's just highlights the issues even more. If Sequoia put half their assets in illiquid companies, that wouldn't be good, but that would be less of an issue because you know all of Sequoia's investors aren't going to pull out at the same time.
Right.
With ARK, that could definitely happen.
Yeah, that's a big difference. Now, a little bug in my throat there. one of the things that that you really nailed, you hit the nail on the head, was your concern about safety issues regarding Peloton's treadmill. That sort of has come into the fore here in the last couple of days. So a couple things on that. A, what tipped you off to that? If you don't mind sharing, I'd love to hear what got your focus on that aspect of Peloton specifically. Once again, that's one that I really have not paid attention to. So maybe the answer to people that have been following the story is obvious. I just saw the headline come out the other day and I went, son of a gun. Edwin called that one. And I was like, well, prescient timing again. Good timing for the interview because I'm going to ask him about it. So what tipped you off there? And then what did you make of the actual release? Do you think there's more to come? Kind of give us the lowdown on Peloton.
Yeah. So I think a month and a half ago, Peloton announced that a 6-year-old died by like getting trapped under one of their treadmills. And, you know, I follow a lot of companies with product issues and safety issues. So anytime I see that, I get really interested in trying to learn more and understand that there's a bigger problem. So I just loosely started following the situation. And then, like a lot of people, I became really interested when 2 weeks ago, the Consumer Product Safety Commission basically said, you know, we're trying to get Peloton to recall all their their treadmills. And Peloton was like, no, there is no issue. This is an isolated incident. So usually companies will voluntarily recall. It's super rare for a company to go against a recall order from the CPSC. Right away, I started getting interested. I read all the media reporting. I read Peloton's earlier statements. I read the CPSC statement, and I tried to understand what made their treadmill unique. And just from doing that, I realized Peloton, I wasn't being honest, and actually did have a real safety issue. For example, the law is that you need to report safety incidents with your product immediately to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Peloton said they reported it immediately, but later it came out that they waited a day to report it, you know, which isn't immediately and which isn't following the law. So that was like one small thing where they were just lying about it. They waited a day, but they didn't. Another thing they did is when the CPSC reached out to them for information, contact information for the family that had that death, Peloton refused to give the contact information and basically like obstructed the CPSC's investigation, because how can they investigate the cause of this death if Peloton isn't willing to share this information? Peloton said it was a privacy issue, that the family didn't want to share their information with the regulator, and that's why they didn't share it. I think that's a little silly. Like, if there's actually a death and a real problem with your product, like, you know, you want it investigated as soon as possible. That supersedes like your desire for privacy. But, you know, that ended up being silly because the family had hired a lawyer, and Peloton also refused to share the contact info for the lawyer for the family. And like, even if the family wanted privacy, there's no reason you can't share the lawyer's contact info so they can start sharing information with the regulator. So that made me really upset at Peloton. And then there were like three or four things in this, in the Peloton CEO's original press release, that just had me scratching my head. Like, normally in a situation like this, where there's been one death and there were reportedly 39 different safety incidences, if you want to be aggressive, what you should say is, we have no plans to recall this product at this point in time, but we're going to be monitoring the situation closely and evaluating new information as it comes in. But like, instead, the CEO is just like, yeah, we're not recalling it. And it's like, you can't just say you're not recalling it. You know, you need to be open to the idea of recalling it if other safety issues come in. Like, every year there's about 8 treadmill deaths, usually with older people. And the fact Peloton had one with a really young kid and a lot of other near-death situations was like a sign that there was something really wrong. And then I wanted to understand.
Well, and how long, Edwin, how long has that treadmill been on the market?
I think like 6 months. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, that's not a very good. That's not a very good stat.
Yeah, and what makes this treadmill different, Zach, is it's higher off the ground than other treadmills. So most treadmills are really close to the ground, so you might slip and fall off it, but you're not going to be pulled under. But Peloton's treadmill is like raised like 4, 5, 6 inches off the ground, enough that like a small kid playing at the end of the treadmill can get sucked under. Mm. And that's exactly what would happen. And one kid died, one kid like legally died but then was resuscitated and came back alive. Pets died under the treadmill. It's like pretty sad, and it's pretty simple. Like, your treadmill's just higher off the ground than most treadmills. It turns out that's a big safety problem, so you gotta fix it or recall the treadmill. Instead, you're just kind of like misleading the public in all your press releases and trying to get in a fight with the regulator. So that, you know, I wrote in my newsletter, like, trust is hard to earn and easy to lose, and I lost like all my respect for Peloton. I think they had a great brand before this, but now it's just like, and now they got a ton of negative, much more negative publicity for it than if they had just like recalled it when they were told to.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about how to say this. I don't want to divulge anything. I don't want to divulge too much, but I have not directly, but I have been involved in interactions with senior management at Peloton, and I'm not acute. You know, I don't know. I haven't researched the situation. What I will tell you is that the attitude that you are expressing is something that I think other people have experienced. I guess I can put it that way, on other issues. I think there's a bit of an air of, we can do no wrong, we walk on water, and kind of believe in your own hype that's going on over there. I don't know if that played into this, but it is interesting. And again, for a variety of reasons, I need to be very careful what I say here. But I don't think that you're off. I don't think you're off base. That is an experience had by many people. on a wide-ranging set of issues. And that's, yeah, that's pretty consistent. That'll be an interesting one to watch, because you were right. I thought they were, and I think, you know, they still are. You know, maybe they don't. Maybe this is a big tarnish to the brand. It certainly doesn't help. But you know what they've done is pretty cool. In the strides forward they made are pretty cool, and hopefully they can, you know, figure it out. And hopefully nobody else gets injured. But certainly one to pay attention to now. But before we move on, did you have anything else on them that you wanted to hit on, or I don't want to assume that you were done on that.
You know, their main product is exercise bikes. I don't think there's going to be anything as serious as a recall there, although some people have also complained that the pedals on the exercise bike, like, become detached, exposing sharp metal, and then you, like, cut your foot on it. That was, like, a little interesting to me, given the recall of the treadmill. From a trading perspective, the company did really well in the coronavirus pandemic. They sold a lot of bikes, so now they're going to be lapping those sales. That might hurt the stock or hurt the perception. I like this CEO, Jim Foley, originally when I was watching his media interviews, because he seemed genuine and passionate and a real fitness guy. But the more I've kind of read, and especially about this recall stuff, I think I have a good spidey sense when it comes to management. And now I'm not feeling Peloton, not vibing with Peloton too much. You know, and I think it's also very possible, like, it's really just an exercise bike with an iPad. I think it's really possible Apple releases a fitness product or some other big company does that really hurts Peloton. So, you know, I haven't done a ton of research on where the stock goes from here. It was down 15% yesterday on the recall. But if you asked me if I was a bull or a bear, even at these prices, I'd be a bear.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. I think there's a lot of bad action in those types of names. The other thing I think, and we'll see how this plays out now, just kind of more of a fundamental level, not really talking about anything scandalous, but one of the trends we're watching, and I'm not sure, and I would think that you've got your eye on it as well, is there's been a lot of selling on good news. That always catches my eye. And then the other thing, too, is, I'm starting to really think that part of the bid up in these tech stocks and part of the run, especially last year and then into the earlier parts of this year, I'm really starting to think that people thought what they saw last year out of those companies was a new growth curve, right? And I didn't really get that was what people were thinking until about a month and a half ago. And I'm sitting there going, you know, I don't think this is a new growth curve at all. I think all you did was front-loaded growth from the next 2 to 4 years and, you know, just slammed it into last year's valuation. And I think these things are going to need some time to digest, at the very least, need some time to digest those valuations. What do you think about that? Do you think that's, you know, because you're seeing earnings reports that in the past, you know, last year would have rallied that stock, you know, 15% in the after hours. Now a lot of these things are getting slammed. What do you think about that? Do you think they were, you know, pricing in a new growth curve, you know, like I was saying, or do you chalk it up to something else?
I think the truth is going to be somewhere in the middle. Some people see the great growth in the pandemic and are like, oh, the growth is going to continue for the next 5 years, and then it's super undervalued. Other people say, well, no, you should really think of this as like a one-time pandemic benefit. I don't think either of those are right, because even like a company like Zoom, once you get that one-time pandemic benefit, 5 years from now, I bet people are going to be using Zoom a ton more than they would had there not been this pandemic, just because so many people are now integrated on it, know how to use it. Like, you know, everybody has this like common operating system, where before everybody had like 10 different tools for FaceTiming and video and that sort of thing. So I think definitely some companies will get a permanent benefit from it.
Whole thing is just saying that I think a lot of these valuations, though, are based on. All right, guys. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we got to cut the interview off here. As always, though, you're going to want to hear what Edwin has to say. He's a bright, up-and-coming analyst, and he's got some great calls, and he's had some great calls. So go to just Google Know Your Risk Radio podcast. You can see the interview right there. You can subscribe to the podcast. So you'll get the interviews emailed to you every week. No cost, no obligation. And even better yet, you can listen to the segments whenever you want. So anyway, have a great weekend. We will be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham now at knowyourriskradio.com. Zach will be back with more Know Your Risk Radio next Saturday at noon on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.